All right, everybody, welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. Joining us on the phone is Charles Key, the former state representative from the state of Oklahoma, and Rick Ojeda, a former FBI agent who was assigned to the Oklahoma City bombing case. Now, the Oklahoma bombing case is back in the news this week, recently, due to the Nichols trial on state charges of murder in Oklahoma, and also a new book called The Third Terrorist, written by a woman named Jaina Davis, who used to be a reporter for the NBC affiliate Channel 4 in Oklahoma City, about Arab connections to the Oklahoma bombing. I just saw actually a replay this morning on C-SPAN of Louis Free saying, well, he didn't have any idea what any of these people were talking about, but he would take a look at the book and so forth. And supposedly a former CIA official last Thursday on Fox News called for the case to be reopened, which would be a heck of an unprecedented thing, especially in the middle of the Nichols trial. So now that the Oklahoma bombing case is back in the news, I thought it would be appropriate to get two people close to as primary source as we can get on what really happened with the Oklahoma City bombing. First of all, Mr. Ojeda was on 60 Minutes 2 with Dan Rather shortly before Timothy McVeigh was executed. And he said on, or I should say, Mr. Ojeda, you said to Dan Rather that you had filed reports with the FBI in your investigation of the Oklahoma City bombing and that those reports still had not been turned over to the defense. At that time, you said you were under a gag order and could not discuss the contents of your missing reports. So my first question is, are you free to talk now? Mr. Ojeda. Oh, no, I guess his phone cut out. Well, shucks, man, that was hell of an introduction for nothing. All right, everybody, slight technical difficulties. My question, Mr. Ojeda, my first question was for you. You were on Dan Rather, I believe right before they executed Timothy McVeigh, and you stated that you had filed reports in the Oklahoma City bombing case that still had not been turned over to the defense. And at the time, you told Dan Rather that you were under a gag order and could not discuss the contents of your missing reports. So my first question is, are you free to talk about those reports now? And if so, what were those reports?
I can talk about them, but basically they were just leads I had conducted in the Oklahoma City bombing case. And the particular lead that I was concerned about was one where a confidential informant had contacted me and asked that I meet with this individual who had some information on the Oklahoma City bombing case that had not been looked into. And the information was basically that there were about at least three or four other people that were involved in the bombing and the planning of the Oklahoma City bombing.
Can you discuss who those people were, or at least in general terms?
In general terms, it was basically a group that was in Elon City, and there were about three or four people that he had named in this interview regarding their implications and their participation in the bombing. And there was McVeigh was one of the individuals, Nichols, and then there were about three or four other people that he had mentioned. And you know, whether the information was true or not, I never found out if any leads had been developed to follow up on this information. And that's what my main concern was that some of this, some of these individuals were in an area where I had worked, and any additional leads that would have come down would have come to me to investigate it. And I just thought that whether the information was true or not, it should have been looked into.
Is it your opinion that the this group at Elohim City, were they tied to any other? You know, Jaina Davis's book has come out and is talking about Arab involvement in this in the bombing. Now, is it your opinion that there are ties between the racists at Elohim City and the Arab terrorist groups?
You know, when we first got called up for the Oklahoma City bombing, and we went up there, our main focus was on Arabs. The information that we received was that there were some Middle Eastern contacts that might have been involved in it, and our whole focus initially was on Middle Eastern groups. And we had conducted leads generated as a result of that. And I remember particularly going to a hotel, and actually we kicked some doors in hotels, and you know, we're looking for Middle Eastern people that we thought might have been involved in the bombing case. And I had this other group came about later on was through additional leads and additional clues that came about during the investigation, where Elon City was deemed to be basically involved in the planning and the execution of the bombing. And I don't know what their ties are to the Middle Eastern groups, and I never got into that, and I just never get any leads concerning that. We focused on Middle Eastern groups at first, and then focus went off Middle Eastern back into Elam City, five people in militia groups.
Well, I'm not sure that those are the same thing. The official story, of course, is that McVeigh and Nichols did it, and they were it was at least hinted strongly in the media and by the FBI and the federal prosecutors that they were tied into the militia movement. But I think the neo-Nazi movement is probably something different altogether. Although, I don't know, that may be a separate question. But, Mr. Ojeda, in the New American Magazine, they said that one of your reports referred to Timothy McVeigh in connection with Elohim City seven times. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? Is there substantial proof of McVeigh's involvement with these guys?
That was the information that I had received. Like I said, I never followed up on any of that because I wasn't told to, and at least when I generated for me to follow up on that information. But when they first came out and criticized my appearance on 60 Minutes 2 and said that none of the information I gathered, you know, pointed to McVeigh or to the Oklahoma City bombing, you know, the whole interview was concerning the Oklahoma City bombing and the planning of it. And then they came back and said I put it on a different file number, which was false also because I don't assign file numbers to leads that I conduct. That's something that the city does. The personnel in Oklahoma City develop the leads and basically just sign the file number to it. So that's why they said they couldn't find the additional interviews because it was misplaced in a different file.
Surely by accident. Mr. Key, former state representative from Oklahoma, can you help us make any sense of this?
Well, it's an ongoing pattern. What happened, and I think this is getting ready to come out yet in new revelations by the AP shortly in the next several days, maybe a week. John Solomon has written a number of stories over the last, I guess, 1.5 years now, revealing information that there was prior knowledge of individuals planning to attack government buildings in Oklahoma City. There's only one federal building in Oklahoma City that's known as a federal building. Some people tried to argue that the IRS building is a federal building, but typically when people refer to the federal building or a federal building, it's typically, you know, the federal building in a city that houses the government agencies of the federal government. And the Murr building was known as the federal building. And there was specific information that some in our government had that there were individuals that were planning to attack the federal building in Oklahoma City, and they had also targeted and surveilled the IRS building in Oklahoma City and government buildings in Tulsa. And those individuals are ones that were either residents of or frequented the Elohim City community or compound, as the government likes to call people that they don't like, the ones that Rick Ojeda just referred to. There's also other individuals that were planning to bomb a federal building, and whether they were connected directly to the people at Elohim City like Andy Strassmeyer and Dennis Mahon and McVeigh and others, we don't know for certain at this point in time, but it would appear there's some kind of connection with at least some of those people. So the information that will be subsequently coming out will further confirm what many of us, those of us up here in Oklahoma City that represent the Oklahoma Bombing Committee and others that have investigated and watched this case, like Bill Jasper with the New American and people at the American Free Press and some others, have known for a long time, and that is that there were individuals in our federal government, meaning the Justice Department, the FBI, and other agencies, that intentionally covered up large portions of the Oklahoma City bombing case, who was involved in it, what government agents and agencies knew ahead of time, if anything, and, you know, other aspects of it. And that's going to be revealed here in the near future, that there was specific knowledge, and what's going to be revealed is that there was a coordinated effort. Typically we call something like this a conspiracy, and I'm going to call it that since they've made such a living off calling me and others conspiracy theorists. There was a conspiracy of individuals in the government to figure out how they can subvert the Brady requirements and other laws to keep information from the defense teams that subsequently represented McVeigh and Nichols, and now in the state trial represent Nichols in the state trial. And how much press it gets nationally is yet to be seen. And we've said, I mean those of us in our group here in Oklahoma City and some of these others have said so many times, well, this looks like this is going to break it wide open, for example. And I don't think it's really broken open yet, but if anything should get some people's attention and rock some foundations, it ought to be official government memos that reveal individuals in an agency planning to subvert the Brady requirements and other laws that require them to make information that they have about a case like this available and pursue those that are responsible for carrying it out. That's a long answer. I apologize for answer to the question, but this has been going on for 9 years now.
Right. Yeah,
that's
the anniversary is in 2 days. Mr. Ojeda, I have to say that Mr. Key's descriptions of deliberate cover-up and obstruction of justice and conspiracy within the FBI and the Department of Justice are ringing really true to these ears. You just said that they, accidentally put the wrong file number on your reports?
Well, and that's what the key is, though, that whether it's intentional or not. And, you know, I can't prove it's intentional, and it'd be really hard to prove, for anybody to prove it's intentional. Part of the problem that you have with the FBI is you've got, I hate to say incompetence, but I mean, in some instances there is this incompetency, and a lot of it deals with upper management. There were several times when, you know, we had evidence that that was misplaced in other cases, and we had forms that we called FD-192s, which is called the Bokey form, and basically if you have a large piece of evidence, you do this form that shows the chain of command. And there are numerous times when you get a call from Oklahoma City or from one of your supervisors saying that they lost that form, or can you backdate one, we can send you another one. And that form is supposed to be something that's, like I said, a chain of command where if you turn it over to somebody, that person signs it, and they sign the time that they received it, and, you know, the location and everything else, and then they would just generally lose these things. It was not uncommon for them to lose memos. It wasn't uncommon for them to lose evidence. They lost photographs and search warrants we did. So, I mean, in order to prove intent in a conspiracy, it's going to be difficult, but, I mean, it looks that way a lot of times. And, you know, the FBI is famous for, you know, just covering their, you know, exteriors, basically. And it's a whole type of mindset in the FBI is that if you mess up, and supervisors, if somebody's going to take the axe or something for it, then they're going to cover up for it. So that's just their mindset.
If I could just interject something here, I was fortunate to meet Rick last year sometime, and I don't ever want to leave the impression that I think that, you know, most of the FBI or a lot of our government agencies, for that matter, are full of people that are trying to subvert the law and don't have any ethics or anything. On the contrary, I think most people are honorable people and they're trying to do what's right, and Rick is one of them. Thank God we've got people like that. So, and I agree with what Rick just said. I found in my investigation of this and involvement in government in general that it's kind of like the old analogy, one bad apple spoils the whole barrel or something along that lines. You know, it can seem that there's a lot more going on and that some of the things that happen are intentional than what really is. A lot of things that has been accused of being some part of the cover-up by the government, I've learned that really wasn't. It was incompetence, or it was just something that was misunderstood. But still, and so I appreciate Rick saying that. I agree with him 100%.
I'm sorry. If I could just kind of add to that, I appreciate your words. But and I don't mean to interrupt, but I mean, you have to understand too the way the FBI is structured. That, and when we talk about the incompetence, it's basically because a lot of the agents are not well trained enough. And the reason why that occurs is because in order to become a supervisor in the FBI, you basically just have to raise your hand. So you've got individuals who have hardly ever worked any cases at all. They may have worked white collar crime cases their whole career. And, they may have worked on a task force or something and worked, never actually handled the case from start to finish. Well, these individuals a lot of times will volunteer to be a supervisor. And in turn, these people are put in command of, something like the Oklahoma City bombing. You had individuals there that have hardly ever worked a case in their life, and now they're supervisors in the Oklahoma City bombing case, and they've got no clue at all how to do a case from start to finish, and it's just that they're ill-equipped. We didn't have a lot of the equipment that we needed to do some of the investigations that we conducted, and it's just the fact that it's not, like Mr. Key said, it's not one of these deals where you have basically a corrupt person trying to do a job, but it's, you just have somebody that's not capable of doing it because they don't have the experience.
Well, but here's the problem, though, is that Mr. Key has been on this case from the very beginning. The New American Magazine, ever since 1995, I think their first issue after the Oklahoma bombing happened, Ambrose Evans Pritchard at the Daily Telegraph in London, there have been piles. I have a whole list here of books written about the Oklahoma bombing. And, you know, how hard can it be for the FBI agents working the case to read the damn newspaper? The truth has been known by the quote-unquote conspiracy theorists about this involvement with Elohim City, about the ATF's undercover informant, Carol Howe, about how Bob Ricks, who was the spokesman for the FBI during the Waco Holocaust, was the agent from, I believe, your Tulsa office that told the ATF, don't raid Elohim City, we'll handle this. This information has been out for years and years and years and years. So how come, if I'm some doofus nobody from Austin, Texas, I know this story cold and nobody in the FBI does? It's because they're incompetent.
I think they do know it. Like you said, Mr. Keyes, I read Mr. Keyes' work on the investigation of Oklahoma City bombing, which is, I mean, every FBI agent probably should read that because he made me aware of a lot of things that I didn't know what was going on in the investigation. And a lot of that's because, and on the Bureau, there's a phrase that they use all the time called a need to know. And you're just given enough information that they feel that you need to know. And that's the problem, is that agents do not share information. They don't share it with other agencies. They don't share it with each other. And basically, you're told to do one lead, go out and do it, report back, and then you probably never hear what even happened as a result of that lead.
And we've discovered that along the way about how the FBI works in that regard, in regard to investigations in the field and how they assign, you know, various investigations or work to agents. And that is what we discovered a lot, what Rick just described. And a lot of them don't know. And as time has gone on, as I or others have talked to different agents that did some work in the Oklahoma City case, you know, they would have a certain attitude and picture of what really was true and what's not true. And, you know, it can be understandable how they can feel and believe, being from their point of view, from their perspective. And it is unfortunate because, you know, we all get colored with the point of view that we're looking at anything from. And I'm not trying to be an apologist for the FBI. I'm just trying to look at it objectively and maintain a certain amount of objectivity. I don't think there's any excuse. I'm not making any excuse for them, because I think as an agency, they have failed tremendously and they need to be reformed and audited. They haven't been audited in such a long, long, long time. But for us to understand, how could Oklahoma City happen? How could 9/11 happen? You know, and the other events, we have to understand fully and completely, you know, how do they function on a day-to-day basis? And, you know, it's a combination of these things. It's a combination of incompetence, the structure that's developed over time, and corruption that exists within the system. And there's some of all of that, I think. And you could probably find that in any corporation in America, for that matter. But it hasn't been dealt with. It hasn't been reformed and audited by those that are responsible for doing that. And that's the legislative branch. And also, I would say the people of this country, enough of them have been educated and woke up enough to demand that the elected officials do the job they're supposed to do.
Well, and you bring up a good point there in the fact that here, this is up until September 11th, this was probably the biggest single criminal act in the 20th century, or at least the second half of the 20th century, and yet Congress never held a single hearing on the Oklahoma City bombing, not in the House, not in the Senate, not the Intelligence Committees, not the Oversight Committees, and that should bring up questions of its own, because, I mean, really, You know, I guess you can spread incompetence all around, but, you know, I just don't think that Arlen Specter and Orrin Hatch and all these guys in the House and Senate, I don't think they're incompetent. I think they must have had plans to hold hearings until somebody told them not to. This is the biggest crime ever.
Well, I don't know how to respond to that, but I do know that at one point when I was trying to determine if some of the leads have been covered that I thought should have been covered, that I did send a letter out to Senator Grassley, Charles Grassley, in order to say that, hey, I thought evidence had been withheld. And I never got a response. And to this day, I still haven't got a response to that letter. And that was brought out on Dan Rather's show also. And, you know, first they denied receiving the letter, and then I keep everything now. I've documented everything I've done, and I keep the certified receipt. So we brought the certified receipt to them, and they showed it to them. They said, well, yeah, that is his office. But like I said, even to this day, nobody's even called me about that, and it's never been discussed at all by anybody in the legislature or Congress or anywhere.
Well, and what I discovered is, and we went to our group, the Oklahoma City Bombing Committee, went to Washington, D.C. Six different times from the period of 1996 to 1998, meeting with various congressmen and senators and their staff, and talked to many of them on the phone and tried to communicate with them through the mails, others, many others, including the Attorney General's office. And so I've got a good picture, I think, of how that operates. So if they're having been in a state legislature, you get somewhat of a picture. Part of the problem, and as many people have heard, is the staff of these congressmen and senators. Oftentimes, information stops at that particular checkpoint. Staff members don't pass the information on to a congressman. Well, whose fault is that? It's ultimately the congressman or the senators, but that's part of what's going on. And then probably the bigger problem, and all in my opinion here, is that most congressmen, most elected officials, don't want to touch a controversial issue like this anyway. As one of my colleagues in the House told me one day, to paraphrase and not to get into the long story, but she responded to me and says, gosh, Charlie, I'm afraid they'll do to me what they've done to you. Well, that really sums up what most elected officials' attitude is they don't want to potentially sacrifice a political, quote, career, you know, by pursuing something like this. And
that is exactly what happened to you, right? Ran out of town.
And elective office has gotten such a lucrative thing that even the best people are influenced by that, by the potential sacrificing of that position, either because, and not just because of the monetary aspects of it, but also because of, you know, you feel like there can be a lot of embarrassment that can come along with taking on a case like this. But also, you can get this kind of, I'm not sure what I want to call it, I don't want to misrepresent it, but you get this perspective that you've got to stay there because you're always better than anybody else that's running against you, see. So you've got to do whatever it takes to continue to get reelected to office. Sometimes that includes not doing some things and deciding to, as I've been told by some others, well, you've got to, quote, pick your battles to fight. And so many compromises get made like that over time, and that can happen not just with elected officials, but again, back to institutions and people within them, like the FBI or Justice Department, that after a while you've compromised so much away that you kind of forget what you're there for.
And that's one of the reasons why a lot of people don't come forward. It's like Colleen Rowley, I think she did it the right way when she did, is that she made sure she had backings of other individuals, that other people knew what she was going to do. She documented everything. Just to come forward and say, hey, you know, the FBI has hidden this or they've done this or that, then you better be ready for a fight, because the first response that they're going to have is that they're going to come after you. And it's been proven over and over again where I had agents call me afterwards, you know, after I was fired from the FBI. They called me and said, hey, I can't believe you came forward with that information, you know, proud of you, but, you know, don't include my name.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you, but, you know, just keep me out of it. That's everybody's afraid. They're afraid of the retaliation.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that shows that we're in a very interesting place in this country where the one state representative and one of the few FBI agents that have the courage to come out with the truth, that both of you had your careers ruined. One ran out of town by the local paper and the rest of the politicians, and the other fired from the FBI.
You can see the news today with Dick Clark. I mean, the first response to anything he comes forward with is you know, you attack the person, you attack the messenger, and, you know, not the message. I mean, you come after him personally and try to find what you can. And anybody comes forward and on the information that's detrimental to the government, or, you know, on even on a case like this, a criminal case, they better be ready to have all their ducks in a row and be ready to take on a fight.
Mr. Key, you mentioned before that there have been quite a few different times in the last 9 years that the people who were following the real story here got their hopes up that something, this time the truth is going to come out, this time is going to be different. I'm thinking particularly of the local grand jury that you guys succeeded in getting impaneled that did nothing but rubber stamp what the FBI had already said. And I wonder if you're optimistic that this state trial of Mr. Nichols is really going to finally break through the wall of mass media silence on this subject.
Well, I am, and the reason, even after, you know, being disappointed so many times over 9 years, I really am optimistic, because one of the things about a case like this, and you can look, I hate to point back at, you know, cases we all know about, but you just think back in time, that as after a major event like this happens, as time goes on, people feel more comfortable coming forward. Some, you know, that know things. People like defense attorneys or government officials or now retired government officials, agents or what have you, feel more comfortable then talking about something than they did right at the moment when it was so traumatic and emotional for a whole country. And there was so much more at stake at that time. Documents can be found that have been hidden for a long time because of people's continued efforts. And so all of that is still in play and will work towards bringing more information out right now, today, and in the time we live in now with this new trial going on. A book like Jaina Davis is coming out, another interest to people investigating this thing and pursuing it. It'll all work together that more information will come out. Will the big smoking gun come out? We'll get the whole answer to everything. Who knows? But I think a lot more will be revealed throughout the course of this trial and, you know, and afterwards.
When I talked to Chris Emery of your Oklahoma Bombing Investigation Committee the other day on the phone, he apparently went to McAllister and sat through a day of the trial with V.Z. Lawton, and he told me that I'm not sure if it had been, if it was the day he was there, the day before or something, but apparently J.D. Cash, the independent reporter from the McCurtain Gazette, showed up at court and said under oath, "Judge, I have, I forget how many boxes full of proof that there's a whole other side of this story, or maybe two more, that the state has not told us about and maybe doesn't even know about." And Chris Emery told me that the judge ordered us, wrote out a subpoena. I'm sure J.D. Cash is willing anyway, but apparently this judge, Stephen Taylor, has demanded now with the force of law that all of those boxes of documents be turned over to the court. And from reading J.D. Cash's work in the past, this is going to open up a whole can of worms as far as Elohim City is concerned, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're actually thinking about doing something like that ourselves. You know, maybe that's, I'm glad J.D. Cash did that. I didn't know he was going to do it, but I'm glad he did that. The issue needs to be brought forth again by whomever, that there's all this information and very competent people have developed it, and most of it, the great majority of it, is not information that they discovered and that the FBI didn't know about, or that they didn't turn it over to the FBI. A, most of it they already knew about. B, it's been made available to the FBI or and or other government entities. You know, our group had a grand jury impaneled in Oklahoma City and Oklahoma County. So that information was turned over to this same district attorney's office that's bringing this case for the prosecution in Oklahoma. But still yet, there's a lot of people that don't know that, just like Rick said and we've been talking about here. There are a lot of people within the system, so to speak, meaning the various government, state and federal institutions that bring the case like this, prosecution and investigative and law enforcement in, that some of them don't know about this. Now, you can bet that the prosecution in this case knows about the information that J.D. Cash has and the information that we have, and most, so much of that is the same information. They have just chosen not to hand it over to the defense and let the general public know about it, and they've chosen not to pursue a lot of those people that participated in this.
Well,
give you an idea.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, sir.
I'm sorry. I thought I was going to touch on that just for a second. To reaffirm what was just said, is at one point, J.D. Cash had actually tried to have a meeting with the FBI, and this was way back when I interviewed him years ago, and he had this similar information back then. He tried to turn it over, and when I contacted the Oklahoma City Bombing Task Force, I was told that, well, you know, just, you know, he's, the guy's a quack. Just, you know, don't even pay attention to him and just disregard it. Well, you know, regardless of what people feel about him, if an individual has information that he feels is beneficial, I mean, it should at least be checked out. And I'm sure that, you know, some of the stuff that JD has probably, you know, is going to be off in areas where it's not very credible. But the key to this thing is that it should have been looked into, and it still should be looked into. They should still follow up these leads, regardless of where they come from. If it's information that needs to be looked at, then they just need to look at it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and a lot of this relies on the judge, in this case, Stephen Taylor. And I've heard lots of rumors that he is very fair. But then again, I heard those same rumors about Judge Mache, who held two sham trials. So I wonder if any confidence can be put in this judge that he's actually going to let the truth come out.
Well, he looks a lot better than Mache does at this point in time, but I do believe that, you know, you're right, that and basically by implying that the proof's in the pudding, you know, in the final analysis we'll all be able to make a judgment because there's a lot more to go. But so far I'd say he gets an A or A-plus for the way he's handling this case. Could I ask Rick a question?
Hey, you sure can.
Hey, Rick, I don't know how much we got to talk about this when we met before because there were so many other people around and so many people were interested in talking to you. But in regards to the issue of individuals in Elohim City and that crowd, so to speak, and then a Middle Eastern connection, do you have an opinion right now or any information that would shed light on whether or not there were individuals that worked, in other words, Americans that worked with Middle Eastern individuals to participate in this bombing or anything like that?
Well, the only thing I have is an opinion. I mean, I didn't do any follow-up work on the information that was given to me that I thought I should have. And like I said, when you're given leads to the FBI, you're told just to do that aspect and you don't do anything else, basically. And especially on a case that's such high profile, is that they generate all the leads to you. With regards to the lead that with J.D. Cash's interview, that was a self-generated lead, you know, contrary to what the Bureau says. They sent me over there and their story about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I just from what I've seen, what I've read since then, and about McVeigh's past and the time he spent over the Middle East, and from talking to different people, and, you know, basically my opinion is that, you know, there was probably, most likely, some type of connection between him and some Middle Eastern people. Now, whether he was actually working for them or doing it on his own and going off and having his own plan with these other people at Elon City, it's anybody's guess.
Mm-hmm.
But just my personal opinion, I think that, you know, he probably was contacted at some point, and he did have some contact with Middle Eastern people, and whether they influenced him just in his mindset or if they actually assisted him, that's something that, you know, I'll never know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one thing we learned early on, and I remember working real close with Glenn Wilburn, who's now passed away. I know some listeners probably don't know that, but Glenn Wilburn was the grandfather of two little boys that died in the bombing. He and his wife, Kathy Wilburn, and their daughter, Edie, who was the mother of the two little boys, got very vocal and involved and had enough interest to really pursue this. I worked with Glenn and J.D. in those early days for about first year and a half after the bombing. And I remember Jaina Davis and others that were interested in this. It was always difficult for everyone to accept that Americans would work together with Middle Eastern terrorists to carry out some terrible tragedy like this. And understandably so. I mean, we've never been faced with that.
Well, but that's easy. They're white supremacists, and they share a hatred of Jews with the Arabs. That's simple.
Right, and we learned that later on. I mean, long story short, a lot of it covered in our report, but an attorney who's been very active in this case and is carrying this suit on behalf of many of the survivors and family members of the bombing against the nation of Iraq for having involvement in Oklahoma City bombing, which is in the federal courts right now, he had had some involvement in a real similar kind of or case that had a lot of similarities to this one, foreign involvement, what have you. He went over to England and in Germany on our behalf and for a number of reasons, trying to interview Andy Strassmayr was one, but also to find out about this subject. Do these white supremacists and, as they're called, neo-Nazis and Aryan Nation types, is there any kind of evidence that they have or do work with Middle Eastern terrorists? And in Europe, there's a lot of evidence. There's a lot of history of it. And we included that in our report in the back as a part of the in the appendix. And that was pretty eye-opening and interesting for us to learn. But most people don't know that. You know, I remember seeing and doing it myself with I remember seeing some of the investigators mentally wanting to get rid of one aspect of this because they didn't see how it could fit together. They wanted to make it either Elohim City and white supremacist or Middle Eastern, and they couldn't make the two come together. They couldn't see it, and so therefore they just kind of eliminated it in those early days. Now I think a lot of people have their opinions have developed deeper about how this case really was carried out, but some seem to still have an attitude that it can only be one or and not both. But that was always interesting to me in the early days, and as time has gone on, now some people it wouldn't compute, you know.
Well, and to be fair, I think it's a lot easier to prove all the connections between the various white supremacists and the bank robbery rings and so forth, and the connections between the Arabs involved. But really, it's McVeigh and Nichols themselves who are the real tie between the two. We have at least some evidence of Timothy McVeigh hanging out with Iraqis, being videotaped at a strip club with Iraqis. We have Terry Nichols' trips to the Philippines, where supposedly he was training with Ramzi Youssef and the Abu Sayyaf group. And those two guys are the ones who we've been concocted this story to believe there's this tiny little story surrounding their actions here. And to really understand the relationship between the Arab groups and or the Arab group working and the neo-Nazi group at Elohim City, we really have to understand the connections that McVeigh and Nichols themselves had with these groups. That's where the connection lies.
Mm-hmm. And that's why I was real curious what Rick knew or what his opinion was based on things that he's learned and things he knows about, because he had a special insight into this that others never get.
Well, yeah, you got to remember too that they're not going to pursue that that route, unless they absolutely have to. And the reason why is that this is probably the biggest crime that in history as far as the United States goes at the time. And they had you got two people there that you're pretty sure did it. And if you dig a little deeper, you're going to find things probably that you don't want to find out about other nations involved in it. Which at the time, if you have two scapegoats, go ahead and prosecute these two and get it over with, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of pressure for them to do that, for the FBI to do that, for the whole government to do it, and kind of just put this thing in the back burner and just get it over with and then go on to the next thing.
What about Rick? Have you ever experienced or heard from any of your colleagues when you were in the FBI of political influence being used in any way, either directly or indirectly?
Political influence about with the case itself?
Well, from elected officials influencing the FBI's work in a case like Oklahoma City or any other one?
Oh, the FBI, it's a political organization. Everything that they do is governed by politics. And you can sit here for days and talk about the influence that, politicians have on the FBI and how certain cases are hot issues and certain ones aren't. You're basically told to keep away from some aspects, certain cases, because of the political ramifications, and then you're told to concentrate on others because it would benefit somebody else politically. I mean, we were so focused at one time that this, they talk about racial profiling and how it's a no-no. But at one time, you know, we were told just to concentrate on these crack cocaine dealers and on the African Americans. And if we brought them a different case that we thought was of a higher magnitude or had encompassed more people, at one time the girls concentrated on the crack issue. And they said, no, we want the safe streets, crack cocaine, black gang members prosecuted and investigated. And if we came up with something else, you know, just they wouldn't authorize the investigation because they wanted us to concentrate on this. So half the cases that we did are absolutely motivated by one aspect or another.
Okay. All right, guys, we're going to have to change this subject before you get me started on the drug war. We don't want that. Okay, now, for folks just tuning in, I'm Philip Drew, the host of the Weekend Interview Show, and I'm joined on the phone by a former FBI agent by the name of Rick Ojeda. Say hi so they recognize your voice.
Hello.
And Charles Key, a former state representative from Oklahoma.
Hello.
And... gentlemen, I'd like, I don't know, I guess just your reaction. You say whatever you like about this, but I have here the Department of Justice Office of Inspector General report about the accusations that a former supervisory special agent named Frederick Whitehurst made about the FBI crime lab. And I'm reading from page 5 here, and I don't want to read this whole paragraph to you. I try to find the best part. They talk in the beginning of this paragraph about how many feet per second of force these explosives have and what have you. And then it says, nevertheless, Williams concluded in his report that the main explosive used at Oklahoma City was ammonium nitrate fuel oil bomb. He acknowledged that he reached this conclusion in part because Terry Nichols, one of the defendants in the case, purchased ammonium nitrate and diesel oil prior to the bombing. Without the evidence of these purchases, Williams admitted that he would have been unable to conclude that ammonium nitrate fuel oil were used. Indeed, Williams stated that based on the post-blast scene alone, it could have been dynamite. I'm suggesting that there could have been other things. That was, I guess, a quote. They're not very good with their quotes in this report. But I wonder what you guys think of the very basic story here that an ammonium nitrate bomb went off parked out in front of the Murrah building, and yet we learned that the proof of that was that they found a receipt for some fertilizer and fuel oil at Nichols' house in the biggest crime of the 20th century.
I don't know if Rick has anything to say about that, but we were real fortunate, V.Z. Lawton and I, V.Z. Lawton being a survivor of the bombing and a member of the Oklahoma Bombing Investigation Committee, we're real fortunate to be able to spend about 2.5 days with Frederick Whitehurst at his home back in 2000. And it was a very, very big education on this overall subject, including what we call the science, the bomb, the building, the destruction of it, et cetera, et cetera. And the more you learn about this case and you learn about the forensic part of it and the what they did, what they didn't do, what they should have done, it just blows your mind. It really does start challenging you. You wonder, what can you believe that the FBI says? And I hate to say that. I hate to say that with somebody like Rick on the phone and many others who are very competent people and have integrity and they've really taken their oath to serve the American people seriously. But when you really start looking at it and looking at many of these cases, that's one of the things it does. And I have come to believe and realize, I don't just believe it and it's not my opinion, I think it's practically indisputable. That's what's really the problem with so many people not wanting to react to and respond to and know about cases like Oklahoma City, because it shakes up their sense of security, their picture of the world, and the way it is and the way it's not, so much that they don't want to go there. They'd rather turn their brain off or turn their ears off.
Well, and I'm not worried about hurting Mr. Ojeda's feelings. He seems like a pretty tough guy.
Yeah.
the only personal knowledge I have on that would be about Frederick Whitehurst himself, because when he first came forward with problems at the laboratory, we were told, and this was nothing that came through in internal memos or anything, but the FBI has a way of getting information to agents. And the information that came on Frederick Whitehurst was basically that he was a disgruntled employee he was a subpar agent, and that, you know, information that he had was incredible. And, but that's the way the Bureau combats things. If you speak out and if you do have credible evidence against the Bureau, what they do is they start a campaign, whether it be, you know, through agent to agent or through supervisor to another supervisor, that try to discredit him and put a stop to it before anything comes about of the information that might hurt the Bureau.
Well, do you
now,
believe that any of those things they said about him are true?
No. I mean, at this point, at the time, you do, because you're in this atmosphere where you're dealing with agents all the time. The only information that you're getting is information that's fed to you through other agents. And it wasn't until I experienced, you know, some of the problems that I had and saw, you know, on a personal basis what they were doing, is that you go back and you start thinking, well, you know, I wonder what they said about this guy, if that was true, or I wonder if all this other stuff they said was true. And so, and then you develop your own mindset when you go out and you start, you know, looking at other people's cases. Like I looked at Frederick Whitehurst's case and just saw that, you know, that basically everything they said about him was untrue, about how what a subpar agent he was, and he was an extraordinary agent from what I understand, and just from what I've seen. But that's just the way that the Bureau combats things when you speak out against them.
What I meant to say on that point about I'm not scared of hurting your feelings for talking bad about the FBI, because I do know that there are a lot of good cops inside the FBI. What I'm scared of when I talk bad about the FBI is that I'm accidentally going to help these folks who are now trying to create an MI5, a domestic intelligence agency, as though they didn't already create the Department of Homeland Security. They're using the September 11th commission now to create the pressure from below to justify creating a new domestic intelligence agency because the FBI is just not cutting it. And I just want to take the stand right now. I do not want to fit into that chorus of voices in that manner of criticism of the FBI. I do think there are serious problems with the FBI, and that the way to fix them is to abolish it, not replace it with another agency. After all, there's nothing about FBI in the Constitution of the United States. They were created to be an intelligence agency in the first place. Their job was to get good information and give it to local and state authorities where they can do something about it. So if anything needs to happen to the FBI, it needs to not be replaced with a domestic intelligence agency. It needs to be scaled back to its original function, where ideally when Mr. Ojeda goes and gets his information about Elohim City, before he even gets back to the office, he stops by the local sheriff's department to drop off what he got. That's what the FBI is supposed to be for. It's local police who are supposed to be protecting our lives and property from crimes on the local and state level.
Well, I'm sorry, I have to disagree with you on part of that.
Okay, go ahead.
And I do see that there has to be some type of, not just stopping off the locals and giving them the information, there has to be some type of policy set in place where you do disseminate information to the right people. And the reason I say that is because I work southeastern Oklahoma. And there's a lot of areas in southeastern Oklahoma that were corrupt. You do have corrupt law enforcement in certain areas down there also. And you can't just go in and if you get information, disseminate it to the local sheriff's office and thinking, hey, okay, this is the right thing to do, and you know, I'm going to protect these people, and I'm going to do this by giving them the information that they need. Because you have areas of people down there where they are connected with law enforcement, and law enforcement protects certain people. I mean, you've got a buddy system down in southeastern Oklahoma like you probably have in southern Alabama and other places.
Well, you make a good point, but corrupt police in southern Oklahoma can't take the guilty off to be tried in another state and perpetrate the kind of cover-up that's been perpetrated for 9 years on this case. Only the national government can get away with the kind of cover-up we're dealing with here today, gentlemen.
Well, I agree, and I just think but you have to have a more focused issue with the FBI. And they've expanded over the years. Like you said, they started off as an intelligence agency. Then they started going to combating drugs, white-collar crime, and they just got off in so many different areas that they're spread so thin that if you want to start an agency and you want to do the FBI over again, then what you need to do is just have them more focused and give them a set issue that they work on, only that, and not just go off in every different direction. And that's what the problem is, that you've got agents going everywhere, and nobody knows what everybody else is doing.
Well, I would just chime in with my thoughts on this. I agree with most of what you said, Philip, that and I certainly don't want to see another agency created. I mean, that would be another, like, nightmarish thing that could happen to us. But FBI. If we think we're going to abolish it, well, then those that want to have another agency will just make the argument that, well, we're going to abolish the FBI, but in the meantime, we have to have something to kind of be kind of a transition to go to. We can't just start abolishing the FBI and not have the law enforcement out there, and a lot of people will feel very fearful of that, and they'll play into their hands, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the only answer is to reform and correct the problems in the FBI and take it back to what its original intent was and purpose. And that's not going to be easy. But it may be impossible. I don't know. But that's the only response, from, in my opinion, to the problems we have, because we've already got way too much government. Like Rick just said, that they've been spread so thin and been given so many other jobs to carry out and take on, that that's part of the problem. We certainly don't need more. We need them to focus on what their job originally was and what they should be doing.
And the other problem you have, too, is how are you going to staff these people? If you look at the Homeland Security, if you look at who runs Homeland Security, you'll see that a lot of the people that are running the Homeland Security divisions are former FBI agents. And also, if you look at some of these former FBI agents, these are the same ones they have problems with in the FBI, and they were either forced out by Mueller and then went somewhere else, and most of them went to Homeland Security.
Great,
so
yeah.
You've got the same people.
This is how they staff the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, is they take all the guys that got fired from the local sheriff's department.
Exactly. Yeah. So you've got the same people staffing different organizations, and they just put them in different positions is all.
Okay. Now, Mr. Ojeda, I know that really the extent of your knowledge on this is somewhat limited, and really, no offense, but your use to me is basically in describing what you investigated and how you were stopped from further investigating it, and how those documents were not turned over. Mr. Key, on the other hand, you're the chairman of the Oklahoma Bombing Investigation Committee. You've written a massive volume the size of a phone book called The Final Report of the Oklahoma Bombing Investigation Committee. And since we're almost out of time here, I basically want to read through a list of wild assertions, Mr. Key, and you go ahead and stop me when I go off the story here. But I'd like to mention quickly that the crater was much smaller than originally claimed. The seismographs, the news footage, and the laws of physics prove that there were multiple bombs inside the building. They even tested a structure at the Eglin Air Force Base in Florida and proved conclusively that only bombs inside the building could have caused the damage. 40-plus witnesses proved that there were multiple John Does. 23 different angles of video of the event remain hidden from the public. FBI hero Danny Coulson was in town 9 hours early, as proven by his credit card receipt from the Embassy Suites Hotel, even though he lies in his book and says he was in Dallas searching for a house to buy when he got the call, and then raced as fast as he could to Oklahoma. The Inspector General's report says that the 4,000-pound ammonium nitrate fuel oil conclusion by Dave Williams of the FBI is based on receipts from Terry Nichols' house, and of course his guilt is based on those receipts as well. Hoppy Heidelberg from the original federal grand jury was thrown off the grand jury and threatened for trying to bring witnesses that were actually relevant to the case before the original federal grand jury. Gary State Lake in Kansas is approximately 200 miles away from Oklahoma City, and apparently the Scotland Yard and other explosives experts have said that if McVeigh tried to drive the bomb that they say he had in the back of that truck in a big dually for 200 miles, that he would have blown himself up on the way there. Terry Nichols was nearly acquitted for the federal government's refusal to follow the real evidence connecting him to the Oklahoma bombing. The original vote was 10-2 to let him go scot-free, and then they only compromised later and convicted him of involuntary manslaughter. And again, the worst criminal act in at least the second half of the 20th century. I think there were some mass murders of black soldiers and stuff that took place prior to World War II that might have been bigger. But at least in the last 50 years of the 20th century, the single biggest criminal act was never investigated by the Congress of the United States. Where did I screw up, Mr. Key? Did I miss something?
No, Bob. I think I would agree with everything you said there. I mean, people will always dispute whether or not an ammonium nitrate bomb described by the feds as being the one in the size responsible for the damage to the building could have done it. And I always thought that would be, far from being settled. But over time, I think the evidence is pretty strong that that bomb alone couldn't have done it. But again, I'm just kind of making an argument here that just an observation is all, that people are always going to dispute that, and I wish we could find out the truth about that, just exactly what was placed in the building, exactly how many bombs of what kind, and what was really in the back of that Ryder truck. It may not have been an ammonium nitrate bomb at all. So, but everything you said there is right on target.
Mr. Ojeda, are you shocked, or are these things you already know?
No, well, they weren't things new at the time, but yeah, I mean, there's since the investigation started, that's the stuff I found out later just from reading Mr. Key's report and from talking to other people and reading other books on the matter. But I'm not shocked, no.
Well, I know that if I was just driving around and I didn't know, I hadn't heard this information before, and I just heard me say that and a former state representative and a former FBI agent tell me that I was right, I would be freaking out. It's been 9 years that we've been led to believe that Doofus, the Army reject, and his buddy did this by themselves. 9 years.
Well, what I've done hundreds of radio interviews, and one thing I've tried to say on a lot of, because I know we're getting to the end here, is for people that are listening to programs like this and listening to information maybe for the first time or for the one of the few times they've heard anything like this, and they want to just dismiss it, what it really means, and it should mean to those people, I would suggest to a listener, if they don't already, if they're not already pretty well versed on some of this kind of information, is it means many of the things that you have held dear, whether that's been a vacation home or retiring someday in comfort or providing a college education to your kids or any of these dreams that you've had, it very well might mean that those are going to be sacrificed or compromised if you don't start getting involved and becoming really educated in what's going on in your country, because a country like ours cannot continue to go on and just absorb these kinds of things. It leads someplace, and if we don't correct it, we'll lose the freedom and the standard of living that we have in this country. I personally hold the freedom to be the most important thing, but if standard of living is that real important to you, you just may lose it all that you've been working for. And it's going to require that people get involved in becoming educated and knowledgeable. And that does not mean listen to Dan Rather and Peter Jennings and all the talking heads on the major network channels. You've got to do some effort to dig in and get educated. And we need that more than ever before for people to wake up and start taking action and correct things that are going on in our country today.
Mr. Ojeda, any final words?
No, I think you said it perfectly. The only thing I can add to that is that we just need more people that when they do question what's going on and they do have questions about, you know, certain aspects of investigations or whether it be in their own life or whatever, is that, you know, the key is you have to stand up and just be willing. If you're attacked for your reasons for standing up, then so be it. But, you know, you just have to have some type of integrity and just basic question if you do have questions.
Okay, now the book is The Final Report of the Oklahoma City Bombing Commission. And Mr. Key, what's your website?
It's okcbombing.org. OKC like Oklahoma City, okcbombing.org.
Great. I want to thank both of you for coming on the show today. This has been excellent.
Thank you for having us.
Been a pleasure. Thank you.
All right, everybody, thank you for listening to the Weekend Interview Show. We're done early today because I already did my first interview earlier in the day. You're just tuning in. Sorry to disappoint you. I'm going to leave a little music playing, and Shorty should be in at 5 o'clock in about an hour to play some cool, awesome Texas punk rock for you. If this issue, the Oklahoma City bombing, has caught your fancy, I suggest that you read many books all about it. There's a brand new one out called The Third Terrorist by Jaina Davis, who I expect to have on the show within a couple of weeks, exploring the Arab connection to the Oklahoma bombing. There's also The Secret Life of Bill Clinton by Ambrose Evans Pritchard of the Daily Telegraph in London. There's a book called Day One. There's, of course, the final report of the Oklahoma Bombing Investigation Committee. Timothy McVeigh's former lawyer, Stephen Jones, wrote a book called Others Unknown. And anyway, there's a whole ton of information out there. WorldNet Daily and The New American, both available on the Internet, have massive archives on the Oklahoma bombing. And if you got a friend who you want to wake up, the Oklahoma bombing story might just be the way to do it. Thanks, everybody, for listening to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Philip Drew. The website, if you want to check any of the archives of my previous interviews, is philipdrew.com, philipdru.com. And my email, if you want to mail me some criticism, is philipdrew, again, one L in Philip and D-R-U for Drew, philipdrew@hotmail.com. And this is Radio Chaos, 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas.